Good afternoon, Rabbi Shmuel Plotzker, coming at you live from my house. It's book club class time. Today is Monday. It is October 16 of the year 23. We're still in the wake of the atrocity perpetrated on Israel, the Hamas Nazis on Shemini Atzeres and Simchas Torah in Israel. And the IDF is going in very soon to Gaza, and they're going to clean the clocks of the Hamas Nazis, kill off every last one of them. That's the hope. And with God's help, bring some sort of peace to the area. I mean, I don't think there's ever going to be any peace, but, you know, you just do what you can. You do your ishtablis and you pray for the best. It's really all you can say. Book club class, we are slowly but surely coming to the end of this wonderful book by Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's called The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, lectures that he gave over the years, the Mizrahi conferences, he delivered them in Yiddish. And this book translates them into a very beautiful English. We're going today to focus in on a lecture called Questions Posed to the Mizrahi as a Servant Before the King, delivered in November of 1955. So God willing, we're going to see that. And I looked over quite a bit of it, not all of it, but quite a bit of it, and that's nice. It's a long essay, goes from page 181 to 203. There's 22 pages. Not sure we could do all of it today. Then comes The Mizrahi and the Jewish Dance of Eternity. That was delivered in 1958. And then finally, might be the last one. Yeah. So we only have two more to go. And there's an epilogue, Reflections on the Six-Day War. That's a small one. Wow. He spoke in June of 67. Okay. So we're almost at the end of the book, and then we're going to do Kol Dodi Dofeik, and then we're going to explore Rabbi Soloveitchik. That may have been an essay. I don't know if it was a full-blown book. I really don't know, but we can certainly research it a little bit. Even if it's just an essay, that's fine. The voice of my beloved knocks. There are six knocks that he talks about, God knocking on the door of the Jewish people. And one of them is the creation of the State of Israel. He considered this one of the great moments in Jewish history. So we're going to definitely, God willing, see that. Kol Dodi Dofeik, we're going to see that. After we conclude this wonderful book. Okay, so here we are. Questions Posed to the Mizrahi as a Servant Before the King. Delivered November 1955. Morai v'rabotai, I came to this conference despite the fact that my journey here was bound up with enormous difficulties. I had to tear myself away from my work. This morning I delivered two shiurim and drew up a challenging program for the next few days, a program for which I must prepare. Yet despite all of these impediments, I am participating in the conference. I came simply to fulfill the obligation of Re'iyat Panim, appearing before you. And here, of course, he's talking about the mitzvah of appearing before Hashem. And that's what the tractate Chagiga in the Talmud, both Babylonian and Jerusalem, is all about, where it is, it is all about seeing and being seen by God. Seeing whatever you can see, there were miracles that took place, and you saw the holy fire come down from heaven, perhaps, and there were 10 miracles that took place all the time in the temple, in Beis Hamikdash, in the first temple times, obviously. And so you had to appear before God to see and be seen. That's what the mitzvah of Re'iyat Panim, seeing by face, appearing before God. And also it's simultaneous. With that is the mitzvah of being Ola Regel, you're going up by foot to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. Re'iyat Panim is a remarkable mitzvah in Judaism. The master of the universe, his presence fills all the earth. See Isaiah chapter 6. Whoever a Jew might be, whether on the street, in the field, at his house, he has a private audience with the master of the universe. It's true. I mean, God's everywhere. Nevertheless, the Torah commanded, quote, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the sovereign God, the God of Israel. Exodus 34, verse 23. End quote. Why? because seclusion with the master of the universe must take place not only in the course of one's daily routine, in mundane life, but also outside of one's routine, in a new place, a hub. The Jew must separate himself for a while from his work, travel to the temple, and once again encounter the master of the universe, with whom he had met on a daily basis in his home. He must come on pilgrimage to Jerusalem and spend time. Riyat Panim demonstrates solidarity with the grand concept of the sovereign God, the God of Israel, and with all those who labor on its behalf. And as I said before, I am now fulfilling the mitzvah of Riyat Panim, top page 182, by making a pilgrimage to this convention. I very often get together with members of the Mizrahi. Many of them are my personal friends, and I discuss Mizrahi issues with them. But I have to come to meet these same friends and colleagues at a conference in order to demonstrate my solidarity with the movement and its ideals and declare before you, quote, I am a companion to all who fear you, God. See Psalm 119, verse 63. You and I believe that it is possible to build the state of Israel in accordance with the eternal halacha. Remember, he's talking to Mizrahi now. And that no matter how great the sacrifices might be, we will not budge from this position. In this connection, we must remember that religious Jewry brings a double sacrifice. See, 1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a man from Ramatayim Tzofim in the hill country of Ephraim. Says Rashi, there were two Ramot, two high places that Tzofot saw each other. That's what's to me understood by Ramatayim Tzofim. Two Ramot Tzofot, two high places which see each other. We have a dual vision, statehood and Torah. In truth, they are two that are one. And for these Ramatayim Tzofim, and for these two high places that see each other, observant Jews offer both a daily sacrifice, like every other Jew in the land of Israel, on the altar of an independent, sovereign defense of the country against millions of Amalekites, as well as an additional sacrifice for the kingdom of Torah, which is also the kingdom of heaven. How about that? Interesting idea. Two high places, two ideals, right? Two visions, each one seeing each other, acknowledging each other. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that every Jew in Israel is offering a carbon to each idea. One is one high place, the state of Israel itself. Okay, for the defense of an independent, sovereign nation against millions of Amalekites. And the other is offering a carbon to the kingdom of God himself. That's the kingdom of the Torah. That represents God's will. But Rabbatai, when we closely examine the passages treating Riyat Panim, seeing and being seen by God, we note a pattern. The verse regarding Riyat Panim repeats itself three times. Once in Parshat Mishpatim, Exodus 23. Once in Parshat Ki Tisa, Exodus 34. And once in Parshat Re, Deuteronomy 16. In Mishpatim, Exodus 23, verse 17, it says, quote, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the sovereign, the Almighty God. Excuse me, in Ki Tisa, Exodus 34, verse 23, it says, quote, three times a year, all your males shall appear before the sovereign God, the God of Israel, end quote. And in Parshas Re, Deuteronomy 16, verse 16, it says, somewhat differently formulated, 3 times a year, all your males shall appear et penei before God your God. End quote. It is interesting that in the middle of these three verses, in the various parshios, a pasek, a thin stroke, appears consistently, separating the phrase the sovereign from the phrase the Almighty, or separating God, the God of Israel, where it appears like that in Mishpatim and Kitisa, as well as Penei, from the phrase God your God in Re'eh. Obviously, you should actually see this inside. But take him at his word, and we keep going. It seems the Torah sought thereby to emphasize the dual function of Re'iyat Panim, of seeing and being seen, that particular mitzvah when you go up to the temple in Jerusalem. First, as I stressed earlier, Re'iyat Panim, the seeing and being seen commandment, is an outward demonstration of Jewish unity, of solidarity with the idea of, quote, the sovereign, or Penei, that we believe in the sovereignty of God and in the primacy of a Torah lifestyle, and that we commit ourselves to organizing and shaping the forms of our behavior in accordance with the Penei, with the moral, ethical Torah form. Top of page 183. Second, it is meant to achieve an inner spiritual revitalization. This is the dual function of Re'iyat Panim, an outward demonstration of Jewish unity. And secondly, meant to achieve an inner spiritual revitalization, a deeper understanding of all of these ideas, bringing us close to the Almighty, the God of Israel, as it says in Kitisa, or the Almighty, your God, as it says in Re. When a Jew would make his pilgrimage for the festival, he would also have an opportunity to learn from the Kohanim and Levites in the temple. Naturally, every Jew has questions, difficulties, and uncertainties, and seeks their resolution. There is, after all, a passage regarding, quote, if a case is too baffling for you to decide, be it a controversy over homicide, civil law, or assault, see Deuteronomy 17, verse 8, sometimes a Jew is confused, perplexed. Therefore, when he comes to the temple, the nation's Torah giants must explain to him those things that he does not understand. And he must resolve the man's doubts and answer the questions that trouble the man. Quote, you shall promptly repair to the place that the Almighty your God will have chosen. They shall announce to you the verdict in that case. That's Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 and 9. It's not enough that the Jew overtly accepts upon himself the sovereignty of Judaism, the idea of the sovereign, or of Penei. Such a demonstration is insufficient. If that were all that were required, there would be no need to make a Jew schlep from the Galilee to Jerusalem. Rather, the goal is the Almighty, the God of Israel, the Almighty your God. The words that appear after the pasek, the explanations regarding the God of Israel, and the encouragement that the lonely Jew from the hills of Samaria receives in the temple from the fact that many of his questions and doubts are resolved, from the fact that the entire ideal of Judaism is made clearer and brighter for him. Rabotai, I too have arrived with two goals. The first, as I said, is the goal of the, quote, the sovereign, of officially demonstrating my sympathy for your work on behalf of the kingdom of Torah. But right away comes a pasek. I have another goal that I wish to fulfill, the goal of better comprehending the ways and means of making that kingdom of Torah a reality, more deeply grasping the Mizrahi ideology in such critical times, which have the quality of a Yom Harat Olam, so that I can return home with more understanding about us, God preserve you, but I am in a state of, quote, if a case is too baffling for you to decide, end quote. Another quote, it is Torah and I must study it. See Gemara Bracha 62a. Before I begin asking my questions, I wish to give the following introduction. Top 184. Terry is going to give two concepts, two thoughts. Number one, I have already retold the story of my grandfather's first Shabbos Tshuva drasha many times. Upon ascending the Bima, talking about Reb Chaim Brisker, imagine being able to say, yeah, my grandfather, and the grandfather is Reb Chaim Brisker. I mean, who in the world can be able to say those words? Okay, I want to retell, I've already retold the story of my grandfather's first Shabbos Shuvah sermon many times. Upon ascending the Bima, he said the following words, quote, the truth is that Chaim is speaking to Chaim. For whom should I rebuke if not myself? Since, however, Chaim obviously can't speak to himself because people will think he's crazy, Chaim will deliver a sermon to a holy congregation of Jews who are more firm and better than he is. But Chaim has himself alone in mind. I don't know about you, but he really meant that, and I would have loved to meet this man. Anybody who says on his level, who could say these thoughts, I'm talking to a bunch of people superior to me, but I'm going to be talking to myself. You want to come along, fair enough. And if we have to say that it's a holy drasha to all of you, all right? Meanwhile, really, the truth is, it's me talking to me. I'm going, wow. And he really meant that. I really, really would have loved to have made this man's acquaintance. I would have just loved to be in his presence. Such a humble person, such a genius and a humble person at the same time. An awe-inspiring genius, and he's humble. I mean, he let people live in his house. It was like a flop house. It was like a motel, and nobody paid any rent, or nobody paid overnight fees. And they would steal the pen out of his hand as he was writing. They didn't even know who he was. It's his house. It's Ryan Brisker. They had no idea. These people, poor people, poor Yidden, you know, passing through. They had no idea who he was. And they started, one guy starts taking out the books from his trunk. Tati, the guy's taking, well, let him take the books. And then the guy uproots the whole sperm shrunk and takes out the shrunk. He says, what's going on? He says, Lazim Azai, Lazim Alain, let him do it. I go, what kind of a person is this? Incredible individual. On his tombstone, two words, his name, and then two words, Rav Chesed. That's how I want to be reminded. Not the developer of a whole new Lumdish way to approach the Talmud. Rav Chesed, very kind. He was. Incredible person. We really, truly ought to do a study on him. Luckily, now there are books out there about him, so it's probably a good idea to do it. Cesare Soloveitchik, my questions are not directed at you as much as they are at me, myself. I am a Mizrahi member, and I ask myself, how should one behave in such a situation and under such circumstances? I'm addressing myself out loud. If you can help me give an answer, I'll be very grateful to you. Number two, I am no politician, parliamentarian, leader, philosopher, or historian. Here he quotes Amos chapter 7, verse 14. He does this a lot. I am not a politician. I'm not a prophet, and I'm not a prophet's son. End quote. I'm a teacher, and I come from a family of teachers. Therefore, you should not put too much stock in what I'm about to say. I speak as an idler. Somebody's like he's idling away his time. And I speak as an idler and as a teacher. If I have the chutzpah to meddle in matters in which only great minds and schooled politicians and leaders have a say, it's only because I remember what the Gemara tells us about Rabbi Yechanina ben Dosa, who prayed for a sick person, quote, as a servant before the king, but not as a minister before the king. See the Gemara, Brachos 34b. He davened to God like he was a servant before the king. For a moment, Rabbi Yechanina ben Dosa forgot all the rules of etiquette and all the prescriptions of Masechta Derech Eretz. And, of course, in the Masechta Derech Eretz, it lays out when one may enter the king's presence and when not, what one must say and what one must not say, what is considered chutzpahdik, and what is considered reasonable to request. Rabbi Chanina cried out in utter pain and sorrow from the depths of his heart instead of playing around with rhetoric and other forms of affectation. And it was specifically on account of his unceremoniousness, formlessness, perhaps even tactlessness, that his prayer was accepted. Hashem appreciates a sincere prayer. He loves a sincere prayer. It doesn't have to be with all the formalities, We all know he's the one true God. And you understand that you're a nothing. So you, when you understand you're a nothing, and you understand how great God is, now we're getting somewhere. Now you're cooking with gas, as the phrase goes, in the 1940s. Now you can call the marshal, right, as in the movie Django Unchained. Now you can go call the marshal. And now you see what results from a real genuine prayer. I mean, of course, there's a certain idea that there's a ceremony involved, ritual, you have to show respect to God. We all get that. We do that generally. But then there are times when you're so overcome and you have got to just unload on God and you come waltzing into the synagogue and there's no ceremony, three steps forward, three steps back, three steps forward. You just go in front of God. You throw yourself down the floor. You say, God, you're the only address over here. I need you. I need you badly to help me out. There's somebody who's sick. Please heal this person. And you are just showing that you're an absolute zero. You're just a servant in front of God. You've got nothing. You've got nothing. And he's got everything. God says, now that's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of prayer that I respond to. You know who you are. You know who I am. Now we can talk. And it gets answered. That's what Rechinina ben Dosa, see the Gemara in Brachos 34b. He cried out in utter pain and sorrow from the depths of his heart. Instead of playing around with rhetoric and other forms of affectation. And it was specifically, and this is worth repeating, on account of his unceremoniousness, formlessness, perhaps even tactlessness, that his prayer was accepted. I, too, speak not as a minister before the king. Don't look for any well-mannered extravagance, political logic, or diplomatic stunts from me in the next hour. I speak as a servant before the king. But I expect a response. The first question, Rabotai, I call it the question, quote, of our forefather Abraham's coin. See Gemara above a comma, 97b. Remember? In which there was an elderly couple on one side and a young couple on the other side. The Gemara above a comma talks about how Abraham had coins like that. Okay, coins minted. An elderly couple on one, a young couple on the other. What do they represent? They represented the old Abraham and Sarah. And then the newly created Avram and Sarah, when they became much younger and they had a child. Cesar Soloveitchik, I have thought a lot about the Mizrahi movement in America, about its present and future. I have a tendency to immerse myself in a topic. And I think much more about the Mizrahi than you might imagine. To what conclusions have I come? Top 185. The Mizrahi can have a glorious future here. Well, I cannot see a future for the general Zionist movement, not even for the left-wing parties. I can see clearly how much the Mizrahi can accomplish. You know, I'm looking back, he said this in 55, and here it is almost 2025. So that's 70 years ago. And looking back over the past 70 years, my personal feeling is the Mizrahi schools have been created. There's no doubt about that. There aren't that many of them in comparison to the Haredi schools, but there are. There are a few in New York. There's one or two in Philadelphia. You have a couple scattered throughout New Jersey in the five towns. You have some in the big cities. You've got Hebrew academies. You got early on you had the day schools. And in the big cities like L.A., Dallas, Chicago for sure was a bastion of the Mizrahi movement for many, many, many years. The Ivy Crown School itself is a testimony to the Mizrahi movement. And so you do find, thank you so much, you do find that, thank you, that the Mizrahi created schools. And so he says, I can clearly see how much the Mizrahi can accomplish. He says, the secret is simple. Among all the spiritual assets that we brought over from the other side of the ocean to this continent, also don't forget Boston, the Maimonides School, which Rabbi Soloveitchik himself founded. Is a Mizrahi-oriented school in the biggest way, absolutely. In New York, you have MTA, the Yeshiva University, and Ramaz, Yeshiva Flatbush come to mind, in the five towns. So you have schools. There's no doubt about that. Among all the spiritual assets that we brought over from the other side of the ocean to this continent, it is specifically the religious values that prove to be the strongest and most viable. All of the dreams about a secular Judaism in America have showed themselves to be false. Hollow dreams, right? Whether they were the Yiddishists, you know, the Workmen's Bund, the Workmen's circle. They had schools. They had Yiddishist-oriented schools throughout New York. They're all gone. Well, maybe there's one. There might be one left in Manhattan. They had also one in the Bronx. Gone. You had Yiddishist-oriented, you know, facilities. Gone. I was in, where was it? Like, some place, and my mother was in, she was in some sort of like a rehab center a couple years ago. She was in this rehab center. They had bought, they literally bought, like, the last Yiddishist bastion of you know, the fort, last fort of Yiddishist culture in New Jersey, where she was in this particular rehab center. It wasn't very, very good, but it did what it had to do. She wasn't very happy over there. Care One is a million times better. But she was where she was for a while. And they had purchased the last Yiddish bastion. And it said that on one of the buildings. It said, you know, Yiddish workman circle. It cracked up. Like, what is, who even sees that anymore? I mean, it's completely dead. Completely dead for the most part. All of the dreams about a secular Judaism in America have shown themselves to be false, hollow dreams. We have a, here in Cincinnati, you have Temple Beth Adam. It's a humanist temple. Who do they worship? I don't know. I mean, Sandy Koufax, maybe, Mickey Mantle. Maybe they only worship Jews. So, okay, so Art Chomsky, you have to be maybe an athlete. Maybe after, maybe Henry Kissinger, they bow to Harry. I don't know. I mean, maybe he's got to be an important Jew, Joseph Lieberman. Maybe they're on their knees to, you know, Mordechai Tzadik, or maybe they worship Maimonides. I don't know. I have no idea. But whatever it is, it's nonsense. It's silly. They worship humanity. Humanity is fabulous. Humanity has been great. I mean, we all know how great humanity has been over the past several millennia. You know, they're constantly kind to each other, especially to the Jewish people. We know how kind the nations of the world are to the Jews. The Nazi Germans showed that in the 1940s. Very kind to Jewish people. And, of course, now the Muslims. Radical Islam is showing itself to be very much a friend of the Jewish people over the past 50, 60, 70 years of nonstop terrorism. Obviously, also worthy of worship. Humanity is worthy of worship. I mean, what could be crazier than this? He says not even Zionism will be able to exist here if it takes on a completely secular form. And he's right. There is a Zionist organization of America, but for the most part, there's not that many of the old timers left of that. Young people are not really attracted to it. You know, it seems to just hold on by a hair, and they're not doing all that great. The fact that the second generation of American Jews are committed to Zion, despite being distant from Judaism, proves nothing. They were raised in Jewish homes. Their parents brought the Zion ideal with them from the old country. As a result, these fundamentally religious sentiments pass to their children. They demonstrate their sense of religious belonging through their loyalty to Zion. After all, it says in the Durham 38a, Moshe only became wealthy via the waste of the tablets. The third generation, which is not from, already lacks this relationship with the land of Israel. Thank you. This Monday, I too had the following experience. An American Jewish young man of the third generation was speaking with me about the political situation, and he wanted to explain to me that Israel's claims are legitimate. He began with the following words, quote, I believe that every American with a sense of fairness and justice will be on our side. But he immediately corrected himself, saying, I mean on Israel's side. This is the attitude of hundreds of thousands of American Jews. Do not fool yourselves. You understand, of course, that a mixture of unlike substances of Marxism and Zionism to the tune of A.D. Gordon, Nachman Sirkin, or Ben-Gurion certainly cannot appeal to the mentality of American Jews. He hits it straight on the head. There's not a single American Jew who's going to be attracted to Marxism and Zionism. That just doesn't appeal. The typical American Jew who aspires to go to Harvard and get an MBA and then climb the corporate ladder, or go to Harvard Law School or Yale Law School, and he's going to become chief, you know, partner in a law firm advising IBM and big companies. What in the world has he got to do with Marxism? This is the craziest nonsense. I just saw a little snippet on the web. Some guy is interviewing some college kids, And he says, what do you think about communism? He goes, oh, kind of great idea. He says, really, what's it all about? He says, oh, we're going to seize the means of production because after all, capitalism is a scourge and it's toxic and it kills everybody who it even benefits and it's colonialist. I mean, all the bourgeoisie. I'm cracking up. This kid's 21 years old. He all he knows now is Marxism. He went to college, never, he fell into the cesspool of insanity. His parents, I'm sure, tried to keep him an American. You know, oh, we're going to live in America, and they'll send him to American public school. He sent him off to Oberlin, he comes back a Marxist. I mean, he could be, send him off to Europe in 1875, and be spouting his crap. I mean, it's the silliest thing. I mean, at Lo Haya Vilo Nivra, whenever it was attempted in the world, a complete and colossal, catastrophic failure. Epic failure everywhere it's implemented. People wind up getting murdered by the state, and they wind up aggravated to the death. They want to get the hell out of there. How do I know? Because everywhere that it's tried, it's a failure. Whether it's the Soviet Union, where Jews couldn't put up with it anymore, because after all, you have no rights. If you're going to be a Jew, you didn't have any rights under communism. We're the state, and we have to go after you and kill you. If we're not going to kill you, we'll throw you into the gulag. And they aggravated Ramosha Feinstein so much, I got to get out of here. He picked up his wife and his kid, David, and they ran away. Where'd they go? Thank God, they came to America. They came to a normal country, a free country, of course, a capitalist, a constitutional republic, where you're going to have free divine rights guaranteed you by God. And the country, the government is created in order to protect your rights, which God gave you. You live in a communist country, you didn't have any rights. Whatever you have, the miserable, wretched atheists, they give it to you. Then they'll take it away from you. They're the God who gives and who takes away. Suddenly they're the God. Everywhere it's tried, it's a failure. And everywhere it's tried, it goes down the tubes. And people say, oh, real socialism was never tried. It's been tried many times, and it fails everywhere because people hate the guts out of it. And thank God the Soviet Union collapsed. We should only hope and pray one day for a collapse of Cuba. I don't know how they survive. They survive on bananas, and they're led by a dictator from year to year, whether it's Fidel Castro, Yimach Shemo, or some other idiot. It doesn't matter. It's always a colossal failure. And people get a little dinghies, and they try to go from Cuba to Florida in order to get away from communism because they hate the guts out of communism. Anybody living under communism hates its guts. They just hate it. The poor Russians hated the Soviet Union. Couldn't wait for that to drop dead. And the Cubans can't wait for the despots and tyrants who are in charge of communist Cuba to drop dead already. Everybody's waiting on the fat little boy with the funny haircut in North Korea to drop dead. But he won't for a while because he's very well fed. I mean, the other ones, people over there live on grass. They literally are living, they're eating grass in the communist North Korea. He, the fat boy, he feeds himself very well because he makes sure that China brings in all the goodies. And there you have it. So proof positive. And Venezuela also. Whoever's in charge is fat and very well fed. The other people, they're slowly dropping dead. They're eating rats out of the dumpsters. Venezuela used to be a very wealthy country. They went communist, and now they went down the crapper. That's the reality of communism. Don't ever think anything else. It's always a failure everywhere. It's implemented. It's been tried, and it fails because it does not appeal to the human nature. It goes against human nature. Ask any college kid. You got an A in politics? Yeah. Well, this guy over here failed. He had no idea what was going on in the class. Could you please take your A, split it in half, you take a C, and he'll take a C. That way he won't fail, and you won't get an A. It's only fair like that. There you go. An equal outcome. What are you saying? Absolutely not. I worked hard for that A. I don't care that guy failed. Nope. You're a good communist, right? But Yenim's money, that you're willing to share. But your own wealth, you don't want to share. Your own good grade, you're not going to split that in half. Of course not. Margaret Thatcher, a blessed memory of Great Britain, she said, socialism works until they steal the last dollar from some citizen. When they're down to the last dollar and they've stolen that and they've utilized that, then the jig is up. Because then they've stolen all the money and there's nothing left to steal. Then they have to collapse. And the collapse they do, that's the reality of it. So we should only hope for a continued collapse of socialism, communism, and the death and destruction of those systems because they are absolute crap and junk. And people are willing to risk their lives to get in a dinghy from Cuba and get to Florida. Now, some people drown in the waters separating Cuba and Florida, but they'll do anything to get away from Cuba. even risk drowning in the water, and many have. And people are running away from Venezuela. Why? Because they can't stand it. I mean, who can? It's unbearable. So, again, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you understand, of course, that a mixture of unlike substances like Marxism and Zionism to the tune of A.D. Gordon, Nachman Serkin, or Ben-Gurion certainly cannot appeal to the mentality of American Jews. Only through religious connection can the bonds between Israel and America be maintained. And it is an indisputable fact that the Torah or halachic version of Judaism has more traction among American youth than all the other versions. The fact that a Torah generation is being raised here in the thousands cannot be denied, even if it is not yet immediately obvious. And so, it seems to me that the Mizrahi has the best merchandise to sell if it knows how to explain and disseminate its ideology. Top 186. Excuse me. The Mizrahi stands on the foundation of the Oral Torah and its entire tradition. The same Oral Torah that stretches from Sinai to Reb Chaim Brisker. Moreover, the Mizrahi understands that within the unending dimensions of the Oral Torah, one can build a state in the land of Israel and a modern Jewish life in the diaspora. This worldview is the quintessence of the idea of a living Torah, of, quote, Psalm 119, verse 46, I will speak of your decrees and not be ashamed in the presence of kings, which we preach to our youth and which we seek to actualize in our daily lives. Top 186. This prompts the question, why does the Mizrahi not have the influence it should have in all areas of Jewish communal life? Where are the young Mizrahi members? Where is the young couple from our forefather Abraham's coin? Do not make up some story that they don't exist. They do exist. If only the Mizrahi would have the religious youth in its ranks, it would be the strongest movement in the Jewish public square. The answer is, we have concentrated so much on the political arena, admittedly a highly important effort, that we have forgotten that ultimately we are more than a political party. We are a Torah movement. We represent a worldview, a grand, profound ideology. We have not produced any religious literature. We have not infiltrated the educational institutions. We have not recruited young members. As a result, we are left with the, quote, elderly couple on one side, and the old man grows older, and the old woman uglier. The miracle of the 20-year-old having the beauty of a 7-year-old has not come to pass. See Rashi, the Genesis 23. And we find ourselves in a very critical position. One can draft an old Beit Midrash Jew into the Mizrahi by convincing him to pay $5 in membership dues and then issuing him a receipt in that amount. In the case of a young person, especially a cultured one, and Jewish youth in America are becoming more and more cultured, one must demand acceptance of the yoke of the mitzvot, not membership dues. Belonging to a party does not mean paying its fees, but believing in its ideology. For a young man, joining a party is like converting, and a convert must be taught the fundamentals of the religion. It is this work, in particular, that we have neglected. Is it any wonder, then, that from time to time, a feeling of solitude and loneliness sets in, and we ask one another, Watchman, what of the night? Isaiah 21, verse 11. In truth, this feeling was a major factor in my decision to come. How can the elderly couple not feel alone when the question of, quote, seeing that I shall die childless, Genesis 15, troubles their minds? Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, I only see the elderly. Where's the youth? We have only the elderly on the coin. Where's the flip side of the coin? Where's the young couple on that coin? And where's the youth? I'm going to die childless. That was Abraham's concern. It's his concern as well. Top 187. I know that you'll point to the B'nai Akiva movement. I must admit that the B'nai Akiva is a magnificent movement. In many places, it sanctifies God's name. But first, its numbers are small, and it has not made inroads into the circles of the religious academic youth. And second, it has an advantage that is simultaneously a disadvantage. It is a pioneering movement. It will prepare boys and girls for the kibbutzim of the land of Israel. A very fine goal. But let us not delude ourselves. American youths are far from becoming pioneers in the land of Israel. And by emphasizing the worthlessness of life here, the movement drives many of them away. Pioneers are necessary. But perhaps more than pioneers, we need to have here in this country an organized youth that is aware of its tasks and ready to fight for its goals and ideals. And by the way, here I think, here's where Rabbi Soloveitchik is a unique kind of Zionist. He was fully entrenched in America once he came here. It's true that he applied for a job as chief rabbi of Israel or something along those lines in the early 40s. But he wound up, upon his father's passing, he took the position of dean and Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanah at Yeshiva University, and he was affiliated there for the next 40 years, or 50 years, early 40s till he passed in 1993. So he was affiliated with YU for 50 years, very long time. After he went to visit Israel for the to be considered for the position of the chief rabbi, he never went back to Israel. He didn't visit Israel. He didn't spend Chagim in Israel. To the best of my knowledge, he didn't go there for conventions. There would have been any number of conventions he could have gone to, seeing as he was the president of the Religious Zionists of America, if I'm not mistaken. And he, I mean, certainly he was he was in a position of authority as he's giving these addresses to the American Mizrahi movement in the 50s. And as the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University with the name Soloveitchik, he could have danced his way into the land of Israel at any time he wanted and spent time there. And I'm not judging him, just saying that he never went back to Israel. He, 50 years, he didn't go to Israel. He was a unique Zionist. A Zionist had never really, truly spent any meaningful time whatsoever in Israel, but he could have spent a lot of time in Israel. I find that fascinating. And over here, he's saying if the Mizrahi movement wants to be a movement and a force for change and for good, then it's going to have to teach the children in America, not necessarily to become kibbutznikim in Israel, but rather to be able to stake out a religious life for themselves here in America. Seems to be what he's saying over here. American youths are far from becoming pioneers in the land of Israel. That's his assessment. He's not saying if we just keep on hitting them hard and keep on indoctrinating them, then they're going to wind up becoming pioneers for the land of Israel. Now, there's no doubt that some young men have moved to Israel over the past years. Those were the products of the Mizrahi movement in America. That's exactly true. And many, many have gone. So, you know, to some extent, he's a little bit wrong. I mean, because the fact is that many thousands picked themselves up and made Aliyah and went to Israel. No doubt about that. So I'm not sure exactly how to understand his feeling. You know, it's kind of negative. You know, American youths are far from becoming pioneers in the land of Israel. Many went to Israel. Now, maybe they didn't go to kibbutzim, but that's not the only way to contribute to the land of Israel on a kibbutz. Picking fruit, that's your whole life. I mean, I'm not denigrating that. You're living in Israel, and that's tremendous. And you're raising a family in Israel. That's tremendous, too. But, you know, in his mind, American youths are far from becoming pioneers in the land of Israel. That's not 100% true. Many did go to Israel. He's saying, and by emphasizing the worthlessness of life here, the movement drives many of them away. If you're going to have so cooked up Zionists teaching your children, and they're going to say, kids, guess what? Your lives mean nothing unless you live in Israel. Typical kids going, I don't know if I want to leave. I mean, you know, I'm 8 years old, I'm 10 years old, 12 years old. I'm not ready to leave my family. And I don't think that we're living a worthless life over here. I mean, I am in a religious school. I go to shul. I daven. I study Torah. We put on tefillin. I'm giving tzedakah. We keep Shabbos and Yontif. In what way is this a worthless life? Oh, because you're not doing it in Israel. Well, I understand your point, but I'm still doing stuff. And even if according to the Ramban, it's just like, you know, you're going through motions that you shouldn't forget that when you get to Israel, you'll know how to hit the ground running. But still, even, you know, the Rambam would say that I'm doing something of value because, after all, the Torah was given and we're keeping it. I mean, you think the people in Europe, they didn't do mitzvahs? Of course they did. And people in Tunis and Libya and Algeria and Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and Iran, well, for centuries and centuries, you know, they weren't doing mitzvahs? Sure they were. Was it because they were going to only hit the ground running? Maybe. I mean, you can argue like that, like the Ramban. But even he lived his whole life in Spain. It's only because of the aggravation he got after the dispute, the vikuach he had with Pablo Cristiani from the King James the First of Aragon. Then the Dominicans got started to aggravate the world, the life out of him. He said, I got to get out of here. And he moved to Israel. I'm not judging him. Just saying that there was a man in his 70s who did not live in Israel. He was a big Tzioni, right? But he didn't live in Israel all his life. He was living in Spain. And it's only because of the whole aggravation that he decided to finally wake up and go to Israel. So even he himself, 90% of his life was lived outside Israel. If you're such a Tzioni, then you should be 20, age of 20, get going, go live in Israel, go create a community, and go sit and learn. I mean, I don't know what to say. I'm not judging him. I'm just curious about the choices people make and the philosophy that they espouse. Sometimes I don't see how they join up. That's all I'm saying. It's curious to me. The typical kid is going to be driven away if he's told by a Hesed Tzioni, your life is really a joke. It's a fantasy. Your life is not really of any value. His pioneers are necessary, but perhaps more than pioneers, we need to have here, in this country, in America, an organized youth that is aware of its tasks and ready to fight for its goals and ideals. And you have to have committed people. If you can have little children who are going to be hakachinik, that your life is meaningless, your Torah observance is also meaningless, but you do it in Jerusalem, is going to say forget about it. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik is afraid of, anyway. In my opinion, he writes, in my opinion, the Mizrahi is not just an Israeli, but also an American movement. Well, that's an amazing thing to say. Wow. I mean, that is an incredible thing to say. It's not just an Israeli movement, it's also an American. The Mizrahi is an American movement. It has much to accomplish here. The more it does here, the more powerful will be its influence in the land of Israel. I'm not sure how that is actually true, personally. I'm not sure that the more you do in America, the more it's going to impact Israel. I mean, you know, you might inflame some kids to embrace Israel. So maybe more numbers, higher numbers will go to Israel. That's possible. Maybe that's where he's going with that. He says, I want an answer to the Talmudic idea of if a case, or the biblical case, if a case is too baffling for you to decide. I want an answer. I'm baffled, he says. What do we intend to do about this? That we've got this movement, and what are we doing about not teaching the next generation enough? I ask what we can do and what I can accomplish in this connection. We cannot continue to tolerate such a situation. This brings me to a second question, which I call the question of betrothal and marriage. It is closely connected with the question of our forefather Abraham's coin. He writes, I have lately read much in the Mizrahi press and bulletins about the merger of the Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi. It seems to me that the last international conference of the Mizrahi World Union in 55, July 31 to August 8, should have implemented this merger between Mizrahi and Apollo Mizrahi. At the present convention, too, the merger should be discussed. I am, as I told you earlier, a teacher. I don't want to be too humble, so I must add that I am a good teacher. I can, thank God, well learn through a folio of Talmud, a difficult comment of the Tosfos, or a hard passage in Maimonides with my students. And on slow days, I expound on a complicated gloss by the Maharsha or even by Maharam Shif. I wish to state openly that I have yet to encounter as challenging a Talmudical discussion with as sharp a comments of Maharsha as the question of the merger. Because the question of the merger baffles me. He says, it's even tougher than any Talmudical conundrum I've come across. And I must admit that I cannot make sense of the question of the merger. I can't make sense out of it. The forced solutions that have been proposed are too subtle and sharp for my brain. Top of 188. I declare that I do not, heaven forbid, criticize anyone for recommending or opposing amalgamation. On the last Mishnah in Uktzin, it says, the Almighty will in the future give each tzaddik an inheritance of 310 worlds. The author of the Tosfos Yontif comments that it applies both to the tzaddik who prohibits and to the tzaddik who permits in a given dispute. Everybody gets his reward. I'm ready to gift 310 worlds to both the prohibiting tzaddikim, who cry that merger somehow represents a danger to religious socialism. And I'm also willing to give 310 worlds to the permitting tzaddikim, who maintain that merger will prove to be a blessing for the movement. These and those are the words of the living God. Erevin 13b. Both will be given the levyasim at the eschatological meal up in heaven. But I, as a halachist, normally expect that when two tzaddikim argue over a halachic matter, then notwithstanding the fact that both deserve 310 worlds, the votes are counted and it is decided that, quote, the halacha follows so-and-so, whether the prohibitor or the permitter. You know the Gemara's expression. The votes were counted and they concluded. See Erevin 13b. At the World Union, they actually did count and conclude, deciding with a strong majority to implement the merger. Good. The permitting tzaddik won this battle. But when we look more closely, we find that nothing has happened. Instead, a game of betrothal and marriage has begun. The two sides have become engaged to one another. The Mizrahi said to Apollo Mizrahi, quote, you are hereby consecrated to me with this ring in accordance with the law of Moses in Israel, end quote. But you know, of course, that the halacha distinguishes sharply between the matrimonial status of betrothal and marriage. With betrothal, the woman is truly consecrated to her husband, but the acquisitions he makes are purely formal. The spiritual union of the two persons is lacking. The fiancée remains in her father's house. The passage in Genesis 2, hence a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife so that they become one flesh. We saw that in yesterday's, 2 days ago's laning of the Torah. It's only realized with marriage when the betrothed come together in seclusion. Seclusion and marriage are one and the same. Only then do they meld into one persona, sharing each other's joys and sorrows. Top of 189. The betrothal has taken place. That much I know. Hapoel HaMizrahi bears an engagement ring from the Mizrahi, but it has the status of, quote, a bride in her father's house. See Psachim 87a. And when I ask, we're on top of page 189, and when I ask, when will the wedding canopy finally, at an auspicious hour, be erected and the marriage, true seclusion, be celebrated? They reply in a whisper that the marriage will never take place. And when I naively press further, does that mean that they will divorce? And they laugh in my face and they answer, who says then that we were betrothed? That never happened. I scream, how is that possible? You're wearing the engagement ring. How can you shout I was not betrothed? They respond that the ring is worthless. The betrothal was executed, quote, on condition that my father agrees. See Kiddushin chapter 3, Mishnah 6. And he does not agree. I'll tell you the truth. In order to enter into such a complicated question of stipulations, retroactive clarifications, and conditional commitments, one must be a greater Talmudist than I am. But jokes aside, the current situation is fracturing the organization, undermining its prestige, and making a laughingstock of us, prompting the challenge, yesterday you said one thing, and today another. A party and a movement as esteemed as the Mizrahi or Apollo Mizrahi, must demonstrate discipline and responsibility. Here he quotes Job, who had spoken, and Hashem lets him have it. Who do you think you are, human being? Did you sit next to me when I created the world, the galaxies, Would you give me some advice? I mean, where were you then? Said God to Job. Job says, indeed, I spoke without understanding of things beyond me, which I did not know. Job 42, verse 3. The question affects our entire future. As I stressed before, the Mizrahi must exit the narrow confines of a political party, must develop an ideology, both for the diaspora and for the land of Israel, and take on new powers. The beginning of the process would be much easier if the Mizrahi were joined by Hapoel HaMizrahi, even though the latter is still a far cry from being a proper movement in America. With all of its shortcomings, the Mizrahi is still much stronger than Hapoel HaMizrahi. But if the match is not meant to be, then we should know that. We make Eliezer's old request once again. Quote, and now if you mean to treat my master with true kindness, tell me. And if not, tell me also that I may turn right or left. Remember, he went to get Rivka as a wife for, I didn't know who her name was going to be, but it was ultimately Rivka for Isaac. And so he's consulting the parents. Let me know. I mean, what is it? Yes or no? Yatz or nish? You got to tell me. This way I can know how to proceed. If you want to say no, that's also fine. I'll go on my merry way, but you got to tell me where I stand. It's only right. We can still accomplish much in revitalizing the movement, he says. I would like to ask something else. If it is true, as I read in the last issue of the Jewish Horizon, which is a poll on Mizrahi's movement, magazine, 1955, that the opposition to merger stems from class consciousness, for unification with the Mizrahi would nullify the sanctity of religious socialism, then, holding aside the fact that the entire idea is silly, we need to know that so that we can tell the students in yeshivas, young rabbis and others. And we will have to ask ourselves whether it makes sense to sacrifice ourselves for the sake of such idolatry. Indeed, sleep now, for if you awaken too late, I fear that we will be in a situation where they will be, quote, raising the alarm in the Beis Medrash. See Erevin 60a. Over here, we're going to launch into a third question concerning chesed, loving kindness, and gevurah, strength. That's going to have to wait. And God willing, we'll finish that off. This is part one. We'll do part two, God willing, next week, Mr. Shem. So I want to thank everybody for coming out. Thank you all very, very much. We got halfway through the speech, and Mr. Shem will conclude next week. I want to thank you all for calling in. Big Ashtayach. Shmuel Plotzker signing off for Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Today, of course, our book club class focusing in, as it is, on the return to Zion, Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik. We've done half the lecture on questions posed to the Mizrahi, and with God's help, as he's serving before the king, and we'll finish it up next week. Thank you all very much. God willing, see everybody tomorrow night, Tuesday night, for Tanakh Tuesday. We're halfway through chapter 22. Hopefully we'll be able to finish chapter 22 this coming Tuesday night. Very exciting. Take care and be well, everybody. Have a good day, safe and successful day. Let today's study of this chapter and also this morning's Talmud go to a lot. I mean, first of all, to the success of the Israel Defense Forces as it cleans the clock of the Hamas Nazis and kills them all. Also to the rescue of all the captives, all the hostages being held by the Hamas Nazis. And finally, all those Jews who are in hospitals throughout Israel who are being nursed back to health from the atrocious, horrific attack by the Hamas Nazis on Shmini Atzeres. May they have a refuah shleima. Let today's Torah study, please God, redound to the benefit of those who need a refuah shleima, those who need to be released from prison, Hamas Nazi prison, and those fighting the Nazis. It's really a three-front thing. I'm asking the source of Limud Torah to go to heal those who need a healing, rescue those who need to be rescued, and success to those who are killing off the Nazis. Amen. Have a good day. See you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.